Welcome to today's podcast. A quick housekeeping item. Our guest today came to us from New Zealand, so you're going to hear some delay in the sound, and even times you'll hear a little bit of ducking or reduction of the sound. So just hang in there with the episode. We think you'll love it. So with that, let's jump into today's episode.
Well, hello and welcome to episode 87 of the Payers and Players podcast. We have a great show for you today, but before we get into our guest, we'd like to ask you to subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitter, or X, and Instagram if you haven't already done so. And we'd be honored if you would subscribe to us on X. We have some great subscriber-only content, including our Class of 2023 Pathway Study podcast and spreadsheet, which takes a look at the tennis recruiting top 100 boys and girls in the Class of 2023 and tracks their UTR and tennis recruiting ranking progress through high school and where they're going to college, and offers some valuable insights into what the pathway of a college tennis player looks like and how it's different for a boy and a girl. Subscribers also get early access to our entire library of podcasts and early releases of the public podcasts. We also have some great research and tools such as our match charts and player journals that we put together. With that, Robert, let's bring on today's guest.
Hey, yeah, Scott, thanks so much for the introduction to the podcast. We've got with us today Chris Kennedy. Chris is the new one of the new coaches at the Tucker Tennis Academy, also coming to us from New Zealand. So, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. I'm really looking forward to it.
So tell us real quick about your tennis background as a kind of a player and a coach. Walk us through what it looked like, how you got introduced to tennis, and then how you also got introduced to coaching.
Yeah, I had quite a late start into tennis. I started when I was 15. I'm from a small town in Missouri, and I grew up playing kind of the traditional baseball, basketball, football. Basketball being my main sport. My freshman year, I really just wanted to have a third sport to play in the spring. I didn't want to play baseball. I didn't want to run track. So I decided to try tennis. I had a few friends playing, and I just really fell in love with it. It was the first individual sport I had played, and I really liked being on my own, and I really enjoyed those aspects of it. So got started into it, but again, I'm from a small town, so nobody really plays. There's no indoor courts. There's no coaches. There's no access. So I was really just on my own to try to figure it out as I went along. I was talking adults into playing tennis again. Guys who had played high school tennis I heard about that lived in the town. I was like knocking on doors and that's actually kind of where my coaching started, I would actually say, because I had some friends my junior, senior year. We didn't have enough for a team, so I had to talk some friends into playing just so we had enough. So I was like kind of coaching them early on just to try to like get them. Yeah, so we could have a team. And even things like I ran a tournament the summer after my junior year so that I could play a tournament that summer because my family didn't have much. So basically any way to practice, that's, I just had to figure out ways to just try to get people to play. And I think that's like I said, that's really where the coaching began, like in kind of my mindset when it came to, I guess getting things done was I was on my own and I had to figure it out.
So how did that background, not a lot going on in your town in Missouri, then you go play college tennis. How did that equip you think, to being a better coach? I mean, you didn't follow a traditional pathway into tennis. So,
yeah.
So how, and you've got about 20 years of coaching experience now or so maybe, how do you think that made you a better coach following a non-traditional pathway?
Yeah, I think it's a good question because I've thought about this before, because growing up playing basketball, I've had this conversation with a few kids. I grew up doing it every day. And so if someone came to me and they said, why do you do this move in this scenario? I would have no idea. I would just say, it's just what I do. Like, it's like a defender comes to me this way. This is what I do. I couldn't explain anything. Tennis, everything had to be learned. I had to like go through every step of the process and try to figure it out on my own. I didn't have private lessons. I didn't have a coach. And so So it hasn't been, I would say it's not the best path to get good at tennis because there's a lot of things that I needed support on. It's been a great path for coaching because I had to look up all the information myself. I had to try to apply it to myself. And I really understand the struggles that players go through when it comes to putting things, implementing the things coaches say. Because all of my coaching was coaches on either YouTube or you know, different websites, and mentors as well. And I had to try to apply all those lessons to myself by myself. And so I really understand the struggles, and it kind of set the tone for my whole coaching philosophy. And I do think there's probably a bit of a chip on my shoulder that, like, you know, I think I could have been pretty good at the sport. Maybe had I gotten into it a bit younger, or if I had a bit more opportunity. So there's probably a part of me that really wants to give that to other people as well. I think I've already thought about being in Tulsa, and I've got, you know, Monette's an hour and a half away. I'm like already thinking, like, there's probably a kid there that needs an opportunity. So I'm going to go to the high school and be like, which one of you guys want to, like, a chance to really, like, expand, you know? It's like that kind of mentality is probably just been hardwired into me because of that.
And so which sort of, you say you referred to some, you know, YouTube channels and something that's on the internet, mentors. Can you give us an example of what instructors on the YouTube that you thought were really good? And if you had any mentors that sort of helped you personally, who would that be?
Yeah. So, Heath Waters is the main one. He's been, he was really instrumental, especially early on, with a lot of the, one, giving me the confidence that I could do this, but also from a technical side, he's a very, very technical coach. He breaks it down, like, extremely detailed. And I've been able to spend a lot of time with him, and that's been really useful because there's no guesswork. If I look at a player, I'm like, I know exactly what you need to do to get better, and I know how you need to do it. But then it's kind of like, over the years, you've learned, you know, I've learned the different pathways to get the job done, right? Like, I think early on, I probably did a bit too much information overload. And now it's more streamlined, but that's a lot of that comes from Heath. And then,
And just to mention that, you know, Heath has been on our podcast episode 43, and, you know, we agree he's one of the best tennis minds. He used to have an academy in Atlanta. They did a lot of coaching, not just for players, but it was for coaches. It was about teaching coaches how to coach. So he's really good at that. So,
I went through his, he had a, several years ago, he had a, an ACE coaching program. Right. It was four 3-day weekends, like 24 hours over the course of a year, and I did all of that. I went through that whole process. So, like I said, that was a big one.
Just take a step back. So after college, after you're done playing college tennis, did you immediately get into coaching tennis, and then you went to work with Heath? Is that how that progressed?
Yeah. So coming into my senior year, I decided to go into, like, athletic administration. So I was doing, like, marketing and game management. Cause I at that point I knew I wanted to be in sport, but I wasn't sure maybe in what way, for about a month. And I realized it wasn't really for me. And so I really got into strength and conditioning. And that was at the time, like, that I was like, that's kind of my path. So I went to the coach at Southwest Baptist and just asked if he needed some help as a GA with strength and conditioning. It's like, actually that, and I need an assistant tennis coach. So we need someone to drive the van. Yeah. We need someone to drive the van. You know, we need someone to practice. And, I was like, oh, sweet. Yeah, I'll do that. And so I was in charge of the whole strength conditioning, which was really cool. It was a great experience. He just hands off. He wasn't even there. Like, he just said, yeah, do whatever you want. Which was awesome. But the thing that kind of stuck out with me with the administration experience and with the strength and conditioning was I was too far away from the action. Like, I wanted to be in a position to move the needle. And so you realize in those roles, you really are just supporting. And the coach is the person who is really you know, they make the decisions. Like, I'm making suggestions and they're making decisions, and I wanted to be the decision maker. And so that's kind of where it kind of sprung into. And then as the strength and conditioning, and then we started into the spring and going to the matches and things like that and sitting on the court, it was just kind of an epiphany that, like, okay, this is what I want to do, and I don't know enough to help these guys, and I need to get better. And that just started, and that's how I met Heath. Was that was like that moment I go, I need to learn more. And I went online, I found his video. It was like a freaking like 45 minute video on the forehand. I was like, okay, there's a lot of information here. It's gonna take me some time to download all this. And so I reached out to him, and he's been unbelievable ever since. I was just talking to him the other day, actually. So that's how I kind of got into it.
Yeah, and every good coach I've ever worked with has a mentor, and I've never met a good coach that became good by reading books and scouring the internet. That was part of it, but the biggest part of it was a mentor, somebody who could literally, you could call, pick up the phone and call, you could text, you could even go visit, that they had already been through it all and could kind of accelerate your knowledge as you go through it. So that kind of leads us to where you're sitting right now in New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about how you got there. And then I want to ask some specific questions about the program and the academy that y'all have built there.
Yep. So in December 2015, I was in Atlanta at the time with Heath, actually, and sitting a little bit between, I don't have to get too much into it, but I was working in Pittsburgh, and I decided to move over to Kansas City and work at a D2 college, and some of the state funding didn't really come through like it was meant to. So I moved down to Atlanta for about a year, and was working with Heath, which is awesome because it's just another great chance to learn more. And so I was looking for kind of my next opportunity, and kind of stumbled across a job in New Zealand, and the job profile fit kind of what I was doing, and I just thought it was a really cool opportunity to kind of expand and like I always say, like, kind of grow my mind and grow my experiences and see what I think of a new country. And the guy I work with, Dwayne Clue, has been great. He's one of my best friends. It's been an amazing experience. And when we first got here, it was just me and him at one club. And he had already kind of done a good job. I think he'd been running for maybe 6 months or a year before that, but he kind of got the wheels going. And, you know, now we've got 7 or 8 locations and, you know, 12 full-time coaches and, you know, 500 to 700 kids kind of coming through. And we've just kind of been growing that together, for the last 7 years. And, it's really experience, meeting all the different kids and families and being on this side of the world, it, you know, being able to spend time in Australia and Asia and these different places that typically, you know, coming from Monett, Missouri, you're not going to have that opportunity. So, yeah, that's kind of how it's all come together.
And so tell me, you know, you mentioned that you have multiple sites, but is there one sort of club that's sort of the center and then you just have satellites, or what does the program look like in terms of, you know, the clubs you use and how many, you know, kids are at a certain club? And do you have like a specific, you know, maybe a elite program for your highest level tournament type players versus your maybe more recreational after school players? And sort of get into the details there.
Yeah, so we kind of have a hub. We have the club we started at, that, like, because they have a thing here called Interclub, where you play for a club and you go play other clubs, like probably similar to like Germany and how they do their clubs, but like at a not, you know, Bundesliga and stuff, it's such a high level, but it's kind of a system like that. But we don't, and that's kind of the problem. We don't really, there's no way to have like a base here because none of them are big enough. Like Campbell Park has like 6 courts and Mount Everett has 5, but only 3 are lit. And then we use St. Cus School, but we can only use it in the summer because netball takes over in the winter. And like I could go on and on, but so our kids are really adaptable because you know, there's some days where it's like, okay, if it's dry, we'll be at St. Cus. If it's wet, we're going to be at Nicholson because we have to use Astro Court. So, program works, though, we do have like say Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, sometime between 4:30 and 7:30 will be kind of our higher level elite groups, depending on the time of year and what courts are available. And then private lessons in between that, and Saturday afternoons, we use a place called Scarborough, which is like a regional facility. So it's probably quite hard to actually explain too much, how we do it. It's a bit complicated. I guess the moral of the story is every time a problem would arise, we found a way to get more access and more courts and hire more coaches and kind of keep expanding. We have recently started a full,
Well, that's what I was going to say. So do you have a full-time program? And, you know, what is a day for a player in the full-time look like?
Yeah, so we have – we recently, in about March of this year, we started – I guess you could call it a full-time program. But really, it's for two players that I coach. One of them is ranked 250 junior ITF. She's 15. And the other one is – he's 13. He's about an 8.5 UTR. And it was more done specifically for them. Because like I said here, like the, because of the court access and time and stuff, you know, the kids don't get to play enough. And so we have to really maximize our time, one, but two, you know, these kids want to compete with the best players in the world. So you go, okay, well, we need a different plan for you. So,
And is homeschooling or online schooling, is that a popular thing in New Zealand like it is maybe in the U.S.?
It's like anything. The New Zealand's like 10 years behind the U.S., so it's coming in now. But it's kind of like guys like me. There's another coach who's doing a good job as well, like kind of educating the parents on like there's a whole nother world out there outside of New Zealand, and if your kid has aspirations of competing in that world, it's going to take more than what you're probably used to. And so these two families get it, and they've been amazing. And it's probably not a great comparison in terms of it's quite a la carte. Like my wife's a very good player still. She played at University of Arizona. She's very fit, and still plays at a very high level. And so, she kind of works as like coach and hitting partner for Aishi, the 15-year-old. So, you know, they'll hit anywhere between 2 to 3 hours a day. And then I'll take her on court for another hour or two to work on some specific things. And then Luke, it's something similar, probably maybe an hour with Briar, hour with me, but being his level, there's a lot more players that he can play with. So we'll kind of bring in different players, and he also does our after school program in addition. For him, homeschool was a lot more about the physical qualities because he's going to be big and strong, but he needs to develop his I guess overall athleticism. So that was a big component for him, was giving him time to really develop his athletic development, but have time to rest and because he's growing and making sure that his body is adapting. Whereas before, when he was in school, it was like, okay, and he went to quite a hard school. So it's like, okay, you're up at 6 a.m., you know, to try to practice for an hour, and then you try to find the gym time, and then he had to go to school, and then, you know, he had to go to afternoon practice, but then he had to do homework and eat. And it's just, for him, like his body, he needs to sleep like 12 hours a day, you know, like if he really wants to grow. And so it just all became a bit too much. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it, like I said, it we just basically have these really customized programs right now for these kind of two specific kids.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that I think Luke is a lefty with a one-handed backhand. And I think my son is the only other one in the world that has that right now, the junior tennis. So,
is your son named Luke as well?
Yeah. So yeah, it's Luke, lefty, one-handed backhand.
If I have a son, I'm not naming him Luke because I don't know if I want a lefty, one-handed backhand. I'll
right, exactly.
I'm not taking any chances.
Yeah. So, anyways, like, you know, people will see me and they'll say, "What were you thinking, given, you know, having this lefty-handed, one-handed backhand? What were you thinking as a coach when either you designed his game style to have a one-handed backhand, or how did that come about?" Like I say, I know that every parent, every coach gets questions about the one-handed backhand because it's just not very common. So what was the thinking with him?
I mean, number one, like I'm kind of – I just view tennis – it's meant to be fun. And so like that's what like kind of like it's a game. And so if a kid likes something like that, I kind of like to promote it. I also think it's really important to be brave. And so I'm like, I don't want to say I'm a contrarian, but like kind of like I just believe that, you know, you have the courage to kind of step out and be different. It kind of sets a tone mentally as well. Like that you're not scared, like you're not just trying to be a lemming, you're not just trying to follow everyone else. You're going, you know, I back myself to do something a bit different and it feels right in my heart, so I'm gonna do that. And so with him side, like he always would step across on his two hand and I just couldn't get him to line his hips up. And I'm just like, man, like and he had a pretty good slice already, and he's, and like I said, he's gonna be big. His mom's like 6 foot. And he's going to be strong and he's quite like sturdy and stiff. One day I was just like, you know what? I was like, let me toss you a one hand. Let's see what it looks like. And he hit it and I go, that looks better. Like it looks more natural. It's going to take some time, but I'm like, you know, to me, the kid needs to be a walking weapon. Like he's, like I said, he's not going to grind you down. So I'm like, you got to have a big serve, big forehand. And we all know the biggest backhands on tour are one hand in terms of like ball speed, RPMs, like you know, like and you know, you got guys like Djokovic who obviously has a great backhand, but two handers are different. Like they're not generating tons of ball speed. They're, you know, they can take on the ball, but I'm like and then he liked it and he was game for it, and he was like, and at that time probably he was like 11, and in the 12U he's probably like top 10. So it wasn't like he was in New Zealand, sorry, in the US, I know that's like, but in New Zealand, if you're like 10 to 15, that probably puts you in the US like 100 to 150 on average, I would say. And so it wasn't like he was this amazing player and we're going to take this huge step back. He was kind of already, he's already going to be a late bloomer. Like his game was already going to take some time. So I was just like, you know, let's maximize this. Like let's instead of having an average backhand, why don't we shoot for great? Like, why don't we try to develop an amazing one hand backhand? Because his two hand was never going to develop into anything other than like solid at best, at absolute best. And his movement, like I said, like he's not Rafa. He's not going to be running into the deuce sideline doubles to hit forehand. So it's like, it just made sense for him.
Yeah. Well, good. No, I like that. I like the thinking. And I think I was probably similar in this, in sort of being a contrarian. And hey, if everyone's doing it this way, you know, look at Shapovalov coming up. He's doing it that way. You know, he had just beat Rafa at the time. And so there's a lot. So I went back and looked at some of his videos, and he was doing it when he was 7, 8 years old. My son had just broken his right wrist. So I was like, let's just give this a shot. And we just stuck with it. And sort of the same thing. You know, he didn't have a great two hander. So, and, you know, may as well make it fun, right?
So and it's funny, like, because I always, sorry, one more thing. I always think too is like there's tennis, but we're also trying to develop the kids' minds for the future. And so I just think it's so important that when you teach a kid that age, that you're going, yeah, it's different, but like I think there's a residual effect of like, I'm willing to step out and be brave and be different. And I think like whether they make it in tennis or not, that's going to pay dividends later anyway. And I'll say for Luke, it's funny. Since then, he's broken his right wrist twice, and he's not had to miss any practice. So, right. You know, there we go. Like, because he broke it right before we went to Florida in July. He's like, oh, it's cool. I'll just put my splint back on, and I'll just carry on. Like, you know, otherwise, like, so I was like, oh, good thing you switched to a one hand. He's like, yeah, sweet.
Well, yeah, you were there at Zonals, Robert, when Luke, he broke his right wrist during the match, and he's like, okay, well, I can just – you know, come back for the next one with the splint on and carry on. So yeah, same thing.
So yeah, so we're smart.
Two things I saw that I like, or that I heard that I like there. The first is, and Scott talks a lot about a player's ceiling, right? So you want as high a ceiling as you can get, and you basically said with the two hander, his ceiling might have been here. And for those that aren't watching on video, I've got my hand kind of here, raising up and down, but His ceiling might have been here, but with that one-handed backhand and him being a walking weapon, you basically determined a higher ceiling. Now, that may have caused a lower floor in the short term, but in the long term, you gave him an opportunity for a higher ceiling, knowing that he was going to have to be an aggressive weapon-style player. That was a challenge you dealt with that player. What's another player or two that you had some challenges and made some decisions so that they could reach their max potential?
Yeah, so when I was in Pittsburgh, there's a kid named Caleb Troy that I met him when he was a freshman in high school, and he I moved there and I was just was cooking in a group, and he was one of those kids that he just always had a good attitude. He showed up ready to practice. His parents didn't have much, so he's only playing a couple of days a week. And he would have what I call it the consistency gene. Some kids just, they get it. They just get how to put the ball in the court. And I've had a few of those over the years. And to me, they always turn out to be quite good players. It's sometimes they're a bit limited sometimes, but that's something you have to work on. But anyway, so I was this kid, he gets it and he's always calm. He had a good demeanor. I was but he was slow as molasses, and he couldn't, he couldn't, break a paper bag. He couldn't get the ball to do anything. And so, I'm like, this kid's, he knows the simplicity of the game. He knows he's got to make balls. And I was like, I can work with that. And so it was just from that point forward. I think at the time when he was 15, he was number four on his high school team. That's the spring of his freshman year. Somewhere between 600 and 800 on Tennis Recruiting, one star. It's one of those scenarios, where you kind of work a deal out with the parents and you go, look, this is how much he needs to play. What can you afford? And then we'll figure it out kind of thing. And so, and for me, I was 25. So I was hungry to prove myself as a coach in the area. And I was this kid can do it. So, he just got better. And a lot of that was, working on his mechanics and positioning and on court movement, and so he kind of kept ticking along, but he started doing some CrossFit, which he got stronger a bit, a little bit for a while, but then his body kind of adapted, and the guy there didn't really know what to do next, and so he just started having him do more and more and more, and then Caleb's body started to break down and he wasn't getting stronger or faster anymore, and it's okay, so then I go, all right, well, now I got to figure out a way to get more athletic, and it's my responsibility. So I reached out to a guy named Joseph Johnson, who's been a huge mentor for me, both strength and conditioning, but also personally. And I said, because I knew the long story, but anyway, he runs a company called Ultimate Athlete Concepts, and he works with some of the top sports scientists in the world. And I was like, listen, I got this kid and I need help. Can you help me with him? And he's like, yep. He's like, come up to Muskegon for a weekend, let me show you through some things. And then we did this back during Skype. So then every Monday I would Skype his workout with Caleb, and he would tell me what to do. And then Caleb would do the workout a couple more times a week. And then Monday we reconvened and we started doing that. And Caleb ended up being 100 on Tennis Recruiting, 4-star, went to Richmond, ended up playing number one there his senior year, got some ATP points. Now he's in New York working for a startup, doing really well. And it's a long story, but it's just an example of that kid needed physical qualities. He had them. He's always been in squads and stuff in groups. He was locked in. He's always been that type of kid. He was a great leader in the group, but if he didn't develop those physical qualities over time, he was never going to get to where he could get to. And so I had to find an answer for that. And that's actually through that strength and conditioning company in Pittsburgh, because kids start seeing what he was doing. And so then they're like, well, we want some of that. So then I started doing that. And then I had to hire someone to do the training who was also mentored by Yosef, and it created this whole, and it's kind of my thing. I realized when you do that, things organically grow. And they just keep ticking over. So yeah, that's one example.
Well, and that's super interesting, because you basically I mean, you've described now two players, one that needed to transition to a one-handed backhand, that his whole game style was to be on offense. Now you described a player that could make balls, but that for him, it was he needed to add some physical attributes to become more athletic, and you found a solution for that player. So basically what I'm hearing you say is regardless of each player's limitations, you're going to find a way to get them where you want them. And that leads me to, you know, there's two types of teachers in the world. As an administrator, I always used to talk to teachers about there's the type of teacher that just says it and they think their job's done once they've said it. And then there's the teacher who realizes that their job's not complete till the child actually understands it. So if you're a math teacher, you're not done until they can actually do what you're trying to teach them to do, whether it's add or solve an equation, whatever. And so what I'm hearing from you is you sound more like the second. Would you agree?
Yeah, I actually don't even understand the first one. I struggle that concept. I don't get people who think that if they say something, then it's on the person to know it versus as a teacher, it's your job to make sure they know it. Like that is the job. And I thought that was normal. And as time has gone on, I've realized that there's a lot of coaches out there who think their job is to say information. And I think that's part of like my journey as a player and then as a coach, knowing how hard it is to learn something, no matter how bad you want to learn it, it's not that easy. And so it's a coach's responsibility to pivot and circle back and try to figure out like how do we get you to where you want to go. That's the fun in it. My whole thing is there's no stone left unturned ever. You can't do that. You can't give up on the kid. It's not the kid's fault if they don't understand what you're saying. It's your fault because you haven't said it in a way that they don't understand yet. And so you just keep going and you keep going.
Yeah. So Scott, we had a guest on a while back. I think he coached at Clemson. You'll have to remind me. Or we heard him on a podcast one time. I can't remember. But he basically talked about every player that he coached ended up at some point having a Mr. Miyagi. And so he described in America, because tennis is so expensive, they all run up on the best ones. Run up on a pro of some sort who ends up taking an interest and basically does what they have to do regardless of what the price per hour is. And just like Mr. Miyagi and Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi spent a lot of time in that movie. And so if you think about an academy that maybe has 20 to 30 full-time players, let's say they have five coaches. Chris, what's the strategy to make sure each individual player, because you just described two of us, and that was a lot of time and energy for you to get those two to their maximum potential. Now, let's say you got 20 to 30. What is the scale up philosophy so that you can get each of those 20 to 30 to their maximum potential, knowing that each of them has their own strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah. So it's giving each individual coach, they have to have their group of 5 to 8 players and it's their responsibility. And then from the leadership down, there has to be, we work as a team. So we, you know, everyone talks about their players and everyone communicates with each other about what they need because, you know, that coach is not going to be the only coach on court with those players, obviously, but there's got to be someone who, for their development. And then there's got to be someone from the top down that's looking at it, every player, and going, okay, how are they progressing? What are the, you know, basically a SWOT analysis on a monthly basis? Like what, you know, where are we doing well? Where are we struggling? Where does the growth have to come from? And the big thing to that too, with the coaches, is getting them to understand, one, it's your job. Like that's part of it for me. Like it's your job. Like this is the job you've chosen. And so it's the best job in the world. But the other thing is, you know, like now, like Caleb, like I said, like he's 26, 7 now, and I still have a relationship with him. Another girl, Sarah Comer, is the assistant coach at East Carolina, and she came down to Florida just to see me when I was there and do some recruiting. And Charlotte Madsen was a volunteer at University of North Carolina. And these are kids I met in Pittsburgh years ago. And they're kids that I still talk to. And so trying to get the parents, the kids, the coaches to understand, this is the beauty of coaching. Like, you spend your time with these families and all these kids from New Zealand. Like, you guys will meet some because they're going to come over. And if they're doing it because of the relationship that we have. And the relationship we have is because how much I care and how much time I put into their development. And not just as players, but as people. And those relationships are going to be the things that we all remember most. And so trying to get the coaches to understand, it's like, number one, your job is to get them better at tennis. And number two, care about them as people, and you will get in return way more than you give. And when I'm 80 years old, I hope these players are still in my life. And you know, my daughter, Aishi, her best friend is this 15-year-old girl that I coach. Like, the only kid, like, she's just like, Aishi, where's Aishi? Like, all the time. And so it's like, it just thing that, like, I love so much. And so, it's really trying to get the coaches to understand, like, don't just punch the clock, because you're doing the player a disservice and you're doing yourself a disservice. And even more importantly, you're doing yourself a disservice is the main thing, because you're going to look back on your career and you're going to go, oh, I made some money. But if you don't have those relationships still, then what have you done? I just don't understand it. So, and that's how it would need to be. Like I said, the coaches would need to have a group and be like, that's your charge. Like, that's who you look after. And I want you to know about them and their families, and because it all plays a factor into the success of the kid.
And what you described there is a long-term development plan. It's not going to happen, you know, quickly. And the problem with a lot of tennis parents is when there's other options, if they don't like the way things are going, there's some new coach that comes in town, they head out. It's really difficult sometimes, I think, to get those, build those relationships. I think the ones that stick it out and they find some, you know, they're not always looking for grass is always greener, this new guy's better, and this new group is, you know, this, that, or the other. It takes a little bit of, you know, the parents have to buy into that too. They have to know that if we're going to move, then we're going to lose all those relationships that we've been building on, got to start over from scratch. And so, you know, I see that a lot in our area where people are just so transient between the clubs, and it's hard to really put into effect what you're describing. But at a place like Tucker, where you have the, you know, the reputation, where everyone knows they're going to get, you know, good training for the time that they're there, that works really well.
And I think that's the beauty of what it could be, is that you'll have different coaches on staff. So it's like different kids will relate to different coaches. And so, but the other side of it is like, you know, I'm sure we'll have some coaches who are extremely good on the tactical side, and some of them are very good on the technical side, and some are very good with footwork and on-court positioning and different things that, like, maybe the things that interest them most. And so we can work as a team to find solutions. So you still have your lead coach, but, like, for example, me, I want to be involved with every kid and know about everything that's going on, and then be able to assist any of the other coaches, and vice versa. Like, I can get assistance as well. And so you put together a team of people that bring different views and different values and understandings, and we can really solve any problem, you know, with the gym and the location and, you know, clay courts and indoor, outdoor. It's like, there's no limitation. And so any conversation about, but we're just in Tulsa, we can't do this, we can't do that, it's just crap. It's just not true. It's just looking for an excuse. So that's what I'm most excited about, is being in an environment where it's like, there's no excuses. Like, I don't, you know, it's the setup is too good. We could be developing world-class players, not just, you know, mid-major D1 or D1, like, you know, let's shoot for the moon.
Yeah, totally agree. And I love the approach. So real quick, Scott and Chris, we may have to have you on for a second time just to talk about the strength and conditioning piece, because I know there are a lot of folks that the strength and conditioning in tennis is so different from most other sports because it's such a repetitive sport. And so the philosophy of how you weightlift, how much you weightlift, do you put on weight? So I'd love probably to have you on to talk more about that soon. But yeah. Scott's got a cutoff here in just a second. So, Scott, do you want to dive into the fast feed? And by the way, Chris, this has been fantastic. Can't wait to have you in Tulsa.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
And before we get to that, just a couple things I've noticed in New Zealand. When I look at UTR and the top, say, 10 players from New Zealand, 8 of them are currently in college or they've recently played college tennis. So is college tennis seen as a real pathway for New Zealand players?
So that's been a fight that I've been fighting, the good fight, for about 7 years now. And the past administration for Tennis New Zealand did not think it was the right path. They wanted to keep players in New Zealand. And I would get into proper heated arguments because if someone stays in New Zealand, they're not going to play tennis anymore. Like that, it's been proven time and time again. And if they do, it's at like a casual level. And so the whole thing is, and what I've said to the kids early on is like, they need to decide that they're going to college at 12. Like it needs to be so early, because the biggest problem here is kids turn 16, 17. If they don't have that clear goal, they drop off. And so you see those players there. There are so many other players who were extremely good who don't play anymore because they didn't set that as a goal, or they didn't have a coach leading that as a goal.
Yeah.
And you know, they get their driver's license. They don't know it exists. They don't understand it. And even if you try to explain it, they don't get it. And so, and then we had administration telling people that college, you shouldn't go, that, you know, they're just going to go there and drink and shag, is that was his exact quote. So it was
sort of true.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, so it was one of those things that, like, it was a bit of an uphill battle. Within our program, it was fine because, you know, we're leading that message. But now the Tennis New Zealand administration is really good. The girl Aichi that I coach, they're very supportive of her. They've got 2 national coaches that are really supportive of college, and they know the value, and that the new head of high performance, Emily, is fantastic. So the future, I think, is really bright for tennis in New Zealand and in terms of that. And, you know, like every small nation, like I try to get them to see, it's like, you want these kids to go pro. D1, major D1, if you don't want to play pro, they don't want you. So it's right. Like, right. It's like, so it is a pro pathway now.
Yeah.
And it's, if, you know, for a little country in like ours without that much resource, I'm like, it's free resource. I'm like, how do you not maximize this? And I mean, shit, I'd be sending kids at 17, like graduate early, like get out of here and like get over there. And that's what they're going to do now. They're really going to look into like getting kids to college and then supporting them, you know, while they're in college and playing events like in the summers and different things like that, and realizing that the best path forward for any Kiwi, unfortunately, is to get out of New Zealand as much as possible, because that's what the world, you know, it's a world sport. So, like I said, it's been a grind. But I think it's in a good place now, when it comes to that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, the top rated or top UTR, New Zealand player that's in college tennis, is it Oklahoma State? Isaac Beecroft, do you know him?
Yeah, I know Isaac. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't know him super well. Our academy, when we started, we really focused on young kids because Dwayne didn't have a reputation. He kind of was similar to me. He grew up like on a farm and ran for early New Zealand. So he's even, crazier than me. And so you know, we started with young kids and started producing 12s and 14s national champions. And they're kind of coming through almost like now. In the recent years.
All right, Robert, let's go ahead.
Well, And to give an idea of population, I just looked it up. Oklahoma's population's almost 4 million. New Zealand's a little over 5. So
wow.
New Zealand's just a little bigger than the state of Oklahoma in population. So to your point, if they want to compete at a high level, being a national champion in New Zealand basically means you're the state champion in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
kind of gives you an idea. I mean, it's like we talk about Everett won the state championship in 7th grade in tennis. And everybody's like, wow. Oh, you know, but the level in Mississippi wasn't that high. So it wasn't necessarily because he was that good, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
To your point, same in New Zealand.
Well, and that's what, like, the girl Aishi that's ranked 250. Like, I had told her from the start because she's been number one right through. She won, you know, 12 nationals at 10, and everyone, you know, tries to pump her up, and you're like, that's not reality. And it's like, chase level, don't chase recognition, don't chase meaningless championships when you know for a fact that is not like the level that you're gonna get to. And so that's been a whole different story, you know, like how to manage that as well. So,
well, you sound just like Trent Tucker when he's talking about the Jinx Bridge. Let's dream beyond the bridge, right? Let's go for bigger things than just to be good here in Tulsa. So that's great to hear. No, I don't know any parent that's gonna be listening to this that will meet you that will say, gosh, I wish his expectations were lower. They're not going to be proud. Your expectations are high, right?
That's actually the main thing for the kids, to get them to understand. It's like, look, like, I push and I have high expectations and super high standards, but it's because I know what you're capable of and I know what you can achieve. And that is my job. It's my responsibility as a coach to hold you to that line. And if I'm not doing that, I'm not doing my job. And players want it. Kids want it. They want organization. They want standards. They may not always say it, but they need it. They need stability. They need to know what to expect, and they need consistency. And so, and we all know the best players are consistent, not just in the game, but the way they approach everything they do. And so as a coach, if you don't represent that, then how can they follow you? You can't lead anyone if you're not representing what you are asking them to do. And so that's what people can expect.
All right. Well, let's dive in the fast feed. So these are quick answers, and I'll start with the first one, then Scott, and we'll go through them, and then we'll wrap up. So, and you know, this is the point where we should probably add some music, like some kind of fun.
Well, you're the editor. You can do whatever you want.
So cue the music. if you were to win the lottery today, what would you do different, or what would you not do different?
My life would be the same. I would say I would build some sort of a facility, but like I would build it like I'd make it kind of crappy still, because I quite like that kind of against the wall. But then I would fund players. I think I would. That's what I would do. I think I would go around different countries, and I would try to find the hungriest kids, no matter the age. And I would. That's probably what I would do. I would try to create an environment of just a bunch of wolves, a bunch of honey badgers, I should say, and just because it's that's my personality. So like that's what I would do. And I would be doing that, and obviously spending time with my family and whatnot. But from a professional view, this is all tennis I think
would,
about.
Yeah,
yeah.
Tennis would still be a big part of it. Makes sense. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah.
All right. Something you've changed your mind about coaching.
Oh, that's a great question, actually. So super technical. I thought that was the secret, because I thought that's what I was missing in my game. That's been great because I know side extremely well. As time has gone on, I've realized everything is relative and everything is connected. And so you have to be really smart about how you frame technical adjustments and how you change things to kids, and always competing. There's never a time that you go, I'm going to change my forehand so that I'm going to take 2 months off. No. Like that does not work, because what's going to happen is you're going to change your forehand, and in practice it'll feel fine. You're going to go to a match and your brain's going to go boop, and the stress is going to just make it go right back to where it was, and you're going to feel like you completely failed, when in reality that's just normal. And so I used to have this thought, it's like, okay, we're going to take 3 months off, I'm going to have this technical block, and we're going to like change the backhand, and then you're going to go back and everything's going to be great. It just doesn't, from my experience, it doesn't work like that. So I think I view everything now as like organism. Like tennis is, it's breathing and moving and changing, and getting the kids to see it's like we're not fixing something, we're improving something, we're adapting something, we're growing it, we're not, it's not broken. It just needs to keep getting better. And that's how I view my coaching as well. It's like, if I mess up, I'm not going, I failed. I'm just saying I'm growing as a coach and as a person. And I think that that's early on. I thought I could really not a warehouse, but you know, like a conveyor belt, like that. You can go, okay, I'll fix this. And then it'll all come together and be a product. And that's just not how it works. It's always growing together.
Yeah. I think every coach that I interact with, young coaches overdo the technical, just like you said. And the more seasoned coaches realize it's just a piece of the pie, and you can't over focus on it because it'll get in kids' heads. What's something you believe to be true that everyone else around you thinks is totally crazy?
Doesn't have to be tennis.
Yeah.
Anything.
At this point, not potential side with the kids and with the parents. It's not that they think it's crazy. I don't think they understand how important it is, which is like the ability, what you're doing, like have blinders on, essentially, like being completely locked into just what you're doing on a daily basis and not getting caught up in everything around. And I know everyone agrees with that. So it's not that they don't believe it, but they don't believe it in their heart. And so people go, what separates the top guys, Nadal and Alcaraz and Federer? And like the whole stuff about, you know, they're putting themselves out there. They're brave in big moments. I think it's like, you know, people hear that, but they don't really believe that that's it. They think that, oh, no, actually they're just special. It's like, but they're not at all. Like it's in their heart. They believe that their life is just a journey of growing and improving. And so if they lose in a moment, if they fail in a moment, they don't take it as the end of their story. And I think that a lot of players and parents, they still think like that, whether they realize it or not. Like, you know, little Johnny's playing a Section 4 final and it's like, you know, he's got to beat that kid because if he doesn't, like, it means he's not where he needs to be at his current age. And they live and die by it. And so that's probably been the biggest thing is, like, I believe that in my heart. And so when I watch a kid, like, that's what I'm looking for is, like, who's serving and balling it, you know, match point down? Like, who's willing to put themselves out there on a limb and to be different? And that's why I say, for your son, Luke, like, I love it. Like, it's like, be different. Like, that, those are the people that make change in the world and do really great things. And so, like I said, I know it's not, everyone would agree, but I don't think people live it. And that's one of the things I try to do with the players is, like, you've got to live that if you want to give yourself a chance.
Yep. Best advice you've ever received?
So this is personal. Okay. I got this from Josef Johnson. He's just a great man, you know, he's a great human being. And he said that in a marriage comes before love. And so
I think you're open and closing your AirPods case and it cuts out.
Go ahead. Commitment comes before love. So within a marriage, you've got to be committed, there's going to be times that are tough and times that, you know, but it's like the commitment to what you're doing. And then that's what leads to, like, kind of like real love. So sorry if that's a bit weird, but that is the first thing that popped in my head.
Because
I also use that different ways as well. Like that vision that I'm going to do something and things are going to pop up and fly by and staying steadfast in this decision. And this is what I'm doing. I did that when I moved to New Zealand. I was like, I'm coming for 3 years, no matter what. And I had different job opportunities and offers and different things, but I was like, I made a commitment to Dwayne and you don't go back on your word. And so I think that's I learned that from Josef. He's that kind of guy.
Makes total sense. Favorite tennis documentary or book? There's so many. It's hard to pick just one.
Yeah. I mean, say tennis specific, but the inner game of tennis is obviously a great one and one that gets quoted heaps. I read a lot of books from all different, areas. I did think that Netflix documentary that they've just done, I think it's quite good. I use that a lot with the players to show that, like, you're not special. Like, these players go through the same emotions and the same fears and the same doubts. And so it's like, I think a lot of times the kids think that they're unique, that they're the only ones who don't, you know, believe in themselves all the time. But so it's really useful to be able to go, look, like, everyone goes through these moments. So I would say that I actually think that documentary was quite good for that.
Agree. It's shocking to me that the top players in the world were still that much in their head, and the confidence went away or came so easily. I was kind of surprised by that.
And favorite show on Netflix, Prime, whatever, something that you've enjoyed
of all time.
What you watching?
In of all time, sure.
Oh, yeah. Man, we've
been recently. What are you watching right now? Either one, or what are you watching now? Yeah.
We don't have anything right now. We were talking about it the other day. We a lot going on, I guess. My favorite show, House of Cards, is my favorite show of all time. Okay. That was. I was funny when I started watching that. I had the flu, and I watched. No joke. I think I watched like 13 hours one day, and I went to lay down. It was the first season, and I went to lay down and go to bed that night, and I had Kevin Spacey talking in my head. I had to get outside and like clear my brain. So I'm like, this guy's like,
yeah,
torture me. Felt like that one. That you know, that one really. And my favorite movie is Troy. I just love that story. I love just Brad Pitt being better than everyone else. Anyway,
all right. In New Zealand, go to restaurants at a tournament. One go to restaurant at a tournament.
So that's the problem here. And the, you get a kid on here. They'll all agree. We don't have a Panera. We don't have a Chipotle. We don't have these like chains that you know you're gonna get what you can get. We have like, which is kind of cool. We have like local bakeries and things, but they, you know, it's like you you don't have that option. I when you say that, I'm like, I have no idea. You probably go to like Countdown, like a grocery store, and you buy some bagels and stuff. Like, one of the things I'm looking forward to.
That's right on Scott's Alley right there. That's right.
The thing I'm looking at. People think it's funny, but they go, what are you looking forward to most being back in the States? I'm like, Chipotle and Eric. And if you ask,
well,
if you ask the kids on this trip, that's all they say. If you ask them, I guarantee all six of them, you go, what's your favorite part of the trip? They're going to say, we went to this amusement thing and Panera. They loved Panera.
Well,
you answered the next question. So
yeah, the next question. Next question literally was, what's the thing you're most looking forward to come back to use in the U.S.? So we'll go to the last one. What's the thing you'll miss most about New Zealand?
The people, easy. The families and Dwayne and the friends that we've made here. And obviously, and Briar's family. So Briar's family's here as well. But they're pretty well traveled, so they'll come over to Tulsa, I'm sure. Yeah, the people and the families and Briar's family and everyone here. That's definitely the hardest thing. From a New Zealand only perspective, humans out of it. It's got so many really positive things and things you can do. And we live right beside like a giant like farm in the middle of the city. And that's where Briar and I actually like really connected and got to know each other during COVID. Like, we'd walk around the farm and pet the cows and sheep. And my daughter's growing up there. So that's probably the thing she's most nervous about leaving. That's like her happy place. So if you guys can suggest something when we get there, that would be very useful. If there's some sort of farm that we could acquire. Some cow petting and such.
There's plenty of that here.
There's plenty of cattle.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that. Well, Chris, this has been great. Thank you so much for being on. We can't wait to have you in Tulsa here soon. And hope everybody enjoyed the episode. And so we can't wait to see you next time.
Thank you so much, guys. I'm looking forward to it.